Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. These podcasts are presented to help explore the impact of the longevity revolution on our congregations and our community. And we invite you to visit our website, jewishsacredaging.com, and the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page, as well as, if you wish to, leave your comments and suggestions to me, Rabbi Address at jewishsacredaging.com. And you can also leave a voicemail message for us on the website homepage. And it is with great pleasure that we welcome to the Seekers of Meaning microphone, Rabbi Mary Zamor, author, editor of a brand new book that's, if I'm not mistaken, being launched as we speak, a book called The Sacred Exchange, subtitled Creating a Jewish Money Ethic, published by the CCAR Press. Mary, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you. And it is indeed in progress. The manuscript is at the printer right now. The book is on pre-order. I've started some pre-publication tour. So we are just going over the finish line right now.
Cool. This is a very interesting concept. CCR sent me the pre-publication, whatever it is, proof. And I recommend this. This is going to be a great study guide book for adult education programming in any variety of conversations, book clubs, et cetera, et cetera. The subtitle, Creating a Jewish Money Ethic. The obvious question is, why?
Well, first of all, I want to recognize that a lot of people, especially in North America, have trouble speaking about money, and it's not a healthy thing. Judaism has such a wealth, forgive the pun, of thought and information about how money can help us interact with one another and the world. How do we relate to one another? And I think people have just so many questions about wealth, about money, and we really want people to have healthy, good, informed conversations guided by Jewish values and ethics.
So is there any danger when you put this book together and when you sat down with the people at the CCAR to think about a book, and it's a very, very inclusive book from a whole variety of different perspectives, that you possibly could be feeding into some sort of negative stereotype about Jews and money? Did that ever pop up in some of the conversations of why we should do this?
Well, not with the CCR Press, but I'll tell you a very quick vignette. About a year ago, I met an acquaintance, someone who I don't cross paths with that frequently, and she asked me what I was working on, and I mentioned this book project. And when I said, creating a Jewish money ethic, she almost shrieked, you can't, you can't. And I said, why can't I? And she did say, because this will feed anti-Semitism and stereotypes about Jews and money. And frankly, I feel like all the more so we need to have these conversations because we, as a Jewish community, can't internalize those stereotypes, and we can't be afraid of them. Dr. Josh Hollow, a fabulous scholar, wrote a chapter for our book called Money Lending and Jews, Falsehood, Stereotypes, and Shame. And it is a fabulous article. It really is a great chapter, and really helps us see the truth of the Jewish contribution to the economy and the transformation of the economy in Europe from the Middle Ages through the Renaissance. And I think when anybody reads this, they're going to have a lot of actually pride in the contribution of Jews and Christians and Muslims to the current economy, the modern global economy.
Yeah, that's a very interesting. I'm glad you raised that from Josh's essay on money lending and Jews and stereotypes, because it actually, you could pull that essay out and give it to any adult education class. Or when I read it, I especially wanted to suggest to congregations that they give it to their confirmation class and have a conversation about that, because these kids are going to be walking straight into college and are mostly ill-informed on how to deal with this. Because Hola really talks about you have to understand things in the historical and religious context before you start talking about anything more global. And it's a very, very interesting historical and very well approachable essay on exactly the historical context of how this, all these stereotypes and money lending issues. And it's very, very worthwhile for of all the many, many, many wonderful essays. I'm glad you mentioned that right at the beginning. Elka Abramson quotes a very famous passage that every rabbi has preached on many, 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 many times. Ein Kemach, Ein Torah. Unpack that for us, if you could, Mary, in the context of what you're trying to do with this book.
Absolutely. So, of course, that literally means no flour, meaning no financial sustenance, no Torah. And of course, then the text offers us the other way, no Torah, no financial sustenance, meaning that they're integrated. We have to see these things as integrated. Many people, especially in, again, our modern age, feel that the spiritual should be shunted off to one side and the material to the other. And the reality is that Judaism has never advocated for that. That we are a religion that has this beautiful, practical foundation to it, meaning that all of our theology and ethics and spiritual nature is integrated into our daily living. And that's what this book ultimately is about taking our Jewish teachings and values and allowing them to guide us in the real world every single day, rather than sequestering them into one little corner of our lives. And so the way we function every single day, and whether it's in the workplace, the marketplace, the way that we relate to our beloveds and our family members with our financial affairs, the way we teach about money and our responsibilities in it, that all has to be infused with values. And again, Judaism has such amazing things to teach us.
You know, you're alluding to this, and this this a theme of the spiritual community, the spiritual encounter, and wealth. I mean, I recall when I was reading through the proof, this old bumper sticker from when I was younger, eons ago, the bumper sticker that said, "He who dies with the most toys wins." As if to say, you know, the acquisition of material things. What, and as you edited the book and walked through this, and I imagine it took, you were very, very involved with this for a long time. Talk to us about what you think is that spiritual connection, the spiritual connection between money and the sacred.
Well, first of all, you see this theme throughout every single chapter of the book. But the first part of the book is this beautiful unit of essays, again, from top scholars speaking in a very lucid, approachable way, exploring all of the sacred texts from the Torah forward to modern times, addressing what is the Jewish approach. And of course, there is no one Jewish approach to anything. There's many strands of thought. And as we function in the world, sometimes we inadvertently function in a way that we have internalized some of those messages, like those of us who have the most or don't have the most, we are something. We are either blessed by God, we are not blessed. We have just earned it ourselves in a vacuum. And so there is so much teaching around our relationship to money, so that, and wealth, and I'm using those interchangeably. I know many economists, for instance, would not. So I just want to recognize that actually Judaism, while there are strands of thought that see wealth as a blessing, more so they see it as a responsibility. more so they see the whole point of life, of course, not what we have, but what we do with what we have, whether that's a little or a lot. And I think those are some of the most beautiful and powerful teachings that we have.
Yeah, you know, you alluded to that first segment. I think Dr. Weisberg, Devorah Weisberg, who's I think still at the LA School of Hebrew Union College,
the seminar. She's the director of the rabbinical program. She just was made a Rabbi Penkin scholar chair.
Good. She's great. Mm. She writes this essay, and I think channels a verse from Deuteronomy that really alludes to the fact that wealth is a gift from God, which is a very interesting interpretation. But just talk to me about that, of how you understand, how you teach that wealth is a gift from God. Does that imply that as such you have a greater responsibility, the greater your economic means, the greater responsibility?
So you could pull out a text like that Deuteronomy text, which is an important foundational text to look at when you're talking about wealth and Judaism. And you could say, well, it's a gift from God. And if I have wealth, therefore I am more blessed and somehow more worthy. But that's not where Judaism leaves it at all. Just as you say, it comes with more responsibility. It comes with the responsibility to give tzedakah, meaning create more justice and equality in the world. You know, often we use in English the word charity, but in Hebrew we use the word tzedek and tzedakah, talking about creating justice and, again, equal measure, tipping the scales to be more equal. So we see that as a responsibility and beholden on all people, no matter what their monetary value. We're even taught that those who receive tzedakah should give tzedakah. And text after text reinforces that message. When we see what we have as a gift from God, not only should we not see that as a meritocracy, that somehow we are better than another, but we should see that everything comes from God, and whatever we have is really God's, and it is just lent to us to be able to do with. So again, we're back to the message of what do you do with it? What meaningful work do you do with what you have, not just to bask in material items?
We're speaking with Rabbi Mary Zamor, the editor and a contributing author to a brand new book called The Sacred Exchange, subtitled Creating a Jewish Money Ethic, being published by the CCAR Press out of New York. Mary, in the beginning of the book, this really interesting section, I got to ask you how you arrived at this, called Small Change, which is it's a nice title. What is that? Because it's basically sort of like the introduction to the formal essays. What is that, and how did you decide to put that in?
Well, in the structure of the book, this is my second anthology that I've overseen. I always like a lot of texture in terms of the written word and the types of writing that we present. So we have these beautiful chapters in six parts to the book. Every part of the book ends with a smaller essay that we call Ethics in Focus. So it's a deep dive on one very finite ethical question. And then following that, we have a section on every part of the book called Talking About Money, which is a little short narrative piece illustrating the themes that arise in that part of the book. The Small Change is an opportunity to get little tiny, about 100, 125 word vignettes. I asked lots and lots of people to submit them from all over the place, all over the world, literally, to submit just a little vignette of what is their Jewish relationship, what are the ways that they interact with each other, the world, through money. And they're tiny little gems. And I know folks will not only enjoy perusing them and thinking of their own stories, But they'll be so useful, whether it's sitting in an adult ed session or with that confirmation class or with your book group, and really be thought-provoking.
Yeah, they're very interesting just to read through them. And first of all, knowing some of the people who wrote them, it's a very interesting way to begin the book with these little vignettes and personal reflections. Can you make a linkage here between the material wealth, which is what, you know, a lot of the focus of the book is on, and what I think a lot of people may jump to when they see the title of the book, and the, let's say, the equal, if not larger, implication implicit in a lot of this, which we'll call spiritual wealth? Is there a purpose in that somewhere in the sacred exchange?
Absolutely. I think it's all about spiritual wealth, because it goes back to what do you do with what you have or you don't have? What is the life of meaning that you're going to construct for yourself and your family and community? And so much of, again, of our, especially American culture, is consumeristic. And as you referred to that bumper sticker before, life is not about how much stuff you have by the end of the finish line. It is how you construct a life of meaning. So to see how we are employers and how even those of us who don't see ourselves directly as employers, how do we do employment in an ethical, upright way that empowers and treats others with the humanity that they deserve? That's a life of meaning. How do we relate to others through our acts of giving, tzedakah, giving money to charity and philanthropy? That's a life of meaning. And how do we relate and raise the next generation in a way, again, that points them towards life of meaning? To me, that's the ultimate spiritual outlet.
Rabbi Neil Gold, in one of the essays, talks about, raises the question, is wealth corrupting? Mm. And it's a very, very interesting essay. He looks at texts, prophetic text, various types of texts, various types of laws. Could you walk us through a little bit of that? You know, that was a very interesting, I mean, I'm sure when you sat down to edit all this, because it really points out the question of, you know, wealth could be corrupting. It could destroy a human being. And really, I know in the Jewish sacred aging work that we do, in some of the discussions we have on the workshop that we do on caregiving, we point out, because families have dealt with this, that you can control an older adult by the withholding or manipulation of money. So wealth and money can corrupt, can it?
Absolutely can. And again, to point ourselves back to ethics, back to spirituality, Rabbi Gold is really challenging us not to fall to those easy traps, to misuse the power that comes with wealth. Again, and it doesn't mean that you're a billionaire when we talk about that whatever money that is in your control can become a corrupting force in your life. So even if you're talking about the way that you give allowance to a child or a gift to a grandchild, is that being given in a way that teaches good lessons, or is it done with control and power dynamics? He especially focuses on life cycle celebrations. Says in some very fiery, well-argued points, is asking especially the Jewish community to think about the way that we use our resources at these moments, and to use our funds and what we do have for better purposes.
Would you recommend, and as you start a speaking tour probably around the country in synagogues, et cetera, once the book, you know, comes out and like you said, you're already starting to do this. What do you think about the institution of curriculum in religious schools about teaching the appropriate sacred approach to money and the money ethic. I don't know of any religious school who does this. What's your opinion on that? Do you think we should do that?
I think we should. I think that we should be teaching financial literacy, not only to children, teens, college-aged populations, also to adults. In the Sacred Exchange, we have a beautiful article, a chapter by two of our rabbis from Austin, Amy Cohen and Alan Friedman. They've done an interesting thing where they've brought in the evangelical Christian Ramsey Solutions, Dave Ramsey curriculum into their adult ed program. And they've built out a Jewish component to it to be more aligned with our values and our teachings. But they've worked with the Ramsey Solutions people to do this. And I think they create a model through their narrative of what they've done in their community, most openly sharing their successes and challenges in doing this, for how we can do this in every one of our Jewish hubs. So whether it's a JCC, a camp, a Hillel, a senior center, a synagogue, I think there's a lot of opportunity to both be teaching the practical side mixed with the Jewish ethics and spirituality. Yeah, in very important conversations.
Yeah, I would hope that this book finds its way into religious school curricula, and I think it's an amazing untouched opportunity to really impact future generations of the responsibility quotient, so to speak, of money, regardless of where you are on the social scale.
Absolutely. And I want to mention that many states are now mandating financial literacy in school education, public school education. And our own state of New Jersey is now considering this. Even if states teach this, which is so important, given the type of debt crisis that we have in America and the huge, very unhealthy gap we have between the richest of the rich and the rest of our population, that it is important still for us as a Jewish community to be teaching it from Jewish values and to be exposing our children and adults to what our tradition has to say about these matters.
Speaking of Jewish values that sometimes get lost in the shuffle, so to speak, there is a very strong section on women, with a whole series of very, very interesting essays from a broad base. Some of the work dealing with Dr. Rosenbaum's essay on Bread and Roses, Jewish women and how Jewish women transformed the American labor movement, the issue of gender pay equity in congregational employment issues. Talk to me a little, and I know you've been involved with this. Talk to me about how this section, very powerful section, found its way into this book, and what you want to do with this section. It's very, very important.
So I'm going to just politely correct you a little bit.
Correct me away.
We actually don't have a section about women's issues. There is representation of women's issues within the book. One of the things I'm quite proud of is that organically, we have at least 50% of our authors are female. But these are all everybody's issues. So I do a lot of work in pay equity in the other parts of my life. So it was important to me to bring that into our outline here for the whole book. And Judith Rosenbaum, who's with the Jewish Women's Archives and again a top scholar, wrote that beautiful piece about Jewish women transforming the American labor movement. She shares wonderful vignettes that we can all, I think we'll all sit up a little prouder knowing that these women came out of our community and in partnership with other women leaders and male leaders too, helped transform labor in America. And of course, this is important not only to recognize where we've come from as a community, what it felt like to be an immigrant community in America and not to have safeguards to protect us, and to also contrast this with you know, what is good and what is not good about working in America today, what still needs to be done and supported. But back to your women's question, I just think that this was, you know, when you look at, again, the wide variety of topics we brought up, this was an important one to lace into really what comes to be over 45 chapters in this book.
How prevalent is pay inequity in the American Jewish community?
Very. Again, I am with Rabbi Marla Feldman, who is the executive director of the Women of Reform Judaism. That's what some people may know as Sisterhood. We are the co-leaders of the Reform Pay Equity Initiative, and that is a coalition of all 17 organizations that are under the Reform umbrella, working to narrow the pay gap that exists within the Reform movement. Which is roughly in for every dollar a man makes within the professions of the Reform movement, woman makes in the mid to high 80s on average.
And that's include the rabbinate, correct?
Absolutely.
And the cantorate?
Absolutely.
Okay. And this is a very well kept secret, is it not?
Well, hopefully not so well kept. We're trying to be as vocal as possible about this, and we have wonderful partners in all of these organizations: the URJ, the CCAR, the ACC, the educators, the temple administrators, really every single group. And we are chipping away at it. We are collecting good data. We're doing analysis of it with a senior economist. We've been creating interventions. We have a website. If you don't mind, I'm going to give a plug to that well.
Plug away.
ReformPayEquity.org. There are materials and interventions, learning and tools for both employees and employers. And really, we want every single hiring committee, whether it's an individual or a committee, and Jewish institutions and synagogues, to use these resources. And from the very moment they look up and say, we need to hire someone, because it really covers every part of the hiring process.
If a congregation or an organization, a JCC, et cetera, wants to pick your brain, bring you in, get some more information from you, how would they get a hold of you, website-wise, email? I mean, what's the contact information?
Okay, well, thank you. So there are lots of ways to contact me. You can email me directly at ZamorM, so Zamor then M for Mary, at comcast.net. You can reach me through the Women's Rabbinic Network website. You can contact me through the CCAR Press, and they'll connect you to me. Lots of good ways.
At CCAR, www.ccarnet.org.
Yes, thank you.
I got to ask you one question here before we start running out of, couple of questions before we start running out of time. There's an essay in there by Rabbi Stoller about something that comes up. I mean, I reflecting back on my days as a regional director, got this question. You probably could line up just about every congregational rabbi in regardless of denomination, and they're going to ask, they've been confronted with, I have somebody who wants to give a donation to the temple, but their actions have been so radically horrible. The way they acquired that money to give us a donation may be suspect or illegal. They are just, you know, they've broken the law. Should we take this money? First of all, it's a great essay, and I'm very, very thankful that you put this in the book, because I think it's going to be very, very instructive. Walk me through a little bit about Rabbi Stoller's essay of the conflict of donations from people who behave badly.
Mm-hmm. So this is a good example of one of those ethical deep dives into one particular finite question that we have in each part of the book. Rabbi Stoller just did a stellar job of exploring this in the tight word count that we gave him. So he starts with the Maimonides text teaching that no one should be restricted from doing a mitzvah, doing a commanded thing, which is giving tzedakah. So the instinct may be to say to someone right off, no, you can't give us money. But then he raises many of the nuanced questions that you started to refer to. So it's not a yes or no question. And I also want to throw into the mix that very often our institutions are also challenged with the fact that someone has given a lot of money, their name is on the building, the plaque is up, and then, you know, 5-10 years later, they're a huge headline in the news, as we're, you know, witnessing weekly in our own society right now.
Every day, right?
And then what do you do? So some of the questions that he raises based in the text that he shares, both from Torah and Talmud and responsum, from among all those, is the person trying to give a donation because they're trying to get good PR? And is that why they're offering a donation at this time? Is it just a part of their normal commanded tzedakah giving practices? It is, if by taking this donation or keeping this donation or keeping the plaque up, it is your institution then basically condoning their behavior and saying this is fine, you know, and so he explores all those questions and brings forward some very interesting texts for to think about. And frankly, I think both his article, his chapter creates a wonderful discussion, just, you know, things to think about, but anybody actually going through that crisis as an institution of thinking, what do we do, should definitely sit with his chapter and go through the text that he presents and the questions he raises.
I would recommend, if there's anybody who hears this, and when we post this on the Facebook page and the website, that is in a congregational board or congregational leadership, colleague, layperson, when you do your board retreat at the beginning of every year to lay out ideas and visions for the coming year, this may be a very good exercise to take this essay, and because eventually most congregations are going to face this. So thank you again for putting that in there. And before we close, I just have one last easy softball question to ask you. What'd you learn, you, Mary, from editing this book? What do you take away?
Wow. I learned so much. I mean, I always liken this to, you know, the ultimate fantasy. Here I had a topic that I was passionate about, I cared about, but to be able to bring together all these super smart people with their expertise into one place and to teach their expertise to us, and to share stories and narrative and raise interesting questions and provide interesting answers. There's, you know, it's almost like when I look at each chapter of this book, it's like looking at a beloved baby. They just have so much to offer. And I've learned so much from these authors. And right now we're working on a study guide, so others can, you know, be able to teach this and utilize these resources.
Rabbi Mary Zamor, the editor and a contributor to The Sacred Exchange, Creating a Jewish Money Ethic, being published by the CCAR Press. Thank you, Mary, for joining us today on today's edition of Seekers of Meaning. And continued good luck with the pay equity work, very important. And good luck with the book. And just take care of yourself. Stay healthy, and hope to speak to you soon. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richie. Thank you.
Thank all of you for listening again to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. And again, we welcome your comments to rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com and invite you to visit our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. These podcasts are recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and our producer, Steve Lubetkin. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you for listening, and shalom.